Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ann, and I'm an addict. It's wonderful to be here, and I thank the East of the Bay Area for asking me to come down here today. You know, a dinosaur. I'm not so sure I'm glad I'm a dinosaur. I remember when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I didn't think I could get 20 seconds without a substance in my body. To be considered a dinosaur today is a beautiful thing. I came to understand from being in Narcotics Anonymous, the most important thing I had to figure out when I got here was I had to figure out why I used. If I didn't know why I used, I didn't feel like I was going to be able to come to terms with changing the behaviors that lived inside of me. And you know, I grew up in a very beautiful home in a nice neighborhood. I went to private school, and everybody, if you looked at my family, you would have thought, boy, that's a really nice family. Inside the doors of that house was a lot of insanity. I had a workaholic father. I had a mother who was a prescription addict. I never had anybody there available emotionally to be there for me growing up, you know. And I lived in a household where the message given was don't think, don't feel, don't talk. And I didn't know what to do with feelings, so I stuffed them, and I learned how to do that probably around 5 or 6 years old. And I remember being a kid and being simple as going to a doctor's office, and if I cried in the doctor's office, getting beat because I was supposed to understand that man was helping me. But nobody ever stopped long enough to ask me, like, what are you fearful of? What scares you in life? Let's talk about this. So everything I got in, any relationship I got in my life, I lived in control of those relationships. I lived in a household where my father was never home. My mother was the controller. She did everything. She raised 2 kids. She did it all. And I thought that that's what you did. I thought a woman's role was supposed to be controlling. I was supposed to have my say over everything was the word. And that's what I lived in. So when I went in relationships, I failed miserably at them because, of course, nobody else wanted to allow me to control them. I realized today that I started using substances about 13 years old, and that was because I had some medical problems that warranted me to be on medications and some pain issues and surgeries and things. But I found out that if I threw a little bit of alcohol in the mix with that, I really started to understand that I could fit in places, because all that time growing up in that house, I just never felt like I belonged. I just felt like I lived there, but I never felt like I belonged. And that sense went with me into school and everything in my life. I just never felt like I fit in any place. So substances became the issue to make me feel better. You know, when I failed in relationships, it was never my fault, and I never took ownership or accountability for any of my actions. I always felt that I was completely self-obsessed, and the world owes me a living, and my wants and needs are the most important, and I expect you to give them to me, and if you can't meet them, then I'm going to leave, and I'll go find somebody else to manipulate to get my wants and needs met. And that was how I proceeded to live life. I moved in a lot of areas, trying that geographical change because of a lot of situations, a lot of situations that came up legally that made me leave town different times, and I always thought that I was going to get better, and I would do better for periods of time. And then all of a sudden, I would get back into thinking my will was important, and I'd want my way again, and I'd want you to fix me because I didn't know how to fix myself, and when that didn't get done, I would go out and get a substance to fix it. When men couldn't meet my needs, substances did. When they couldn't meet my needs, I was stuck. I didn't know where to go. I tried to get into a marriage, and I did it because I thought it was the thing I was supposed to do, and it was a certain age. I was 26. My family was all over me because of my failures in life. So I thought a marriage was going to make me better, and I tried that. I knew walking down the aisle I had no business getting in this marriage. I knew it. I wanted to turn to my father so desperately and say, please, I can't do this. This is wrong. And I looked up and saw 250 people, and I thought, I can't stop now. Needless to say, the marriage didn't last. I unfortunately got high the entire day and got to the point where I embarrassed myself, but more so embarrassed my parents and all my family, because they threw me out of the wedding. That's a damn shame when the bride gets thrown out of the wedding, but I got thrown out of the wedding. They told me I couldn't drink anymore, and I said, well, he's paying for it, and your job is to serve me. And the bartender said, no, I'm going to serve you. I said, well, I don't need you to serve me. So I proceeded to hike my dress up, jump over the bar, and serve myself. And I was carrying on like a lunatic, you know, and I didn't think there was anything strange about that behavior. That's what's really frightening. I thought that was okay. Those people were supposed to do what I said that day. I did that control thing, always lived in my life. So I left and didn't care. Who cares? Who needs them? You know, that wonderful effort attitude. Who cares? And went on this honeymoon, and 9 months later, he was gone. Of course, it wasn't my fault. I made up a whole story. Addicts are so good at that. I made up a whole story about how he was a bum, couldn't keep a job, and I caught him cheating, and who needs him anyway? That brought me back into my family's, like, poor Ann thing. Let's fix Ann again. I knew that would work, and it did for a period of time. Needless to say, I spent the next probably 7 or 8 years of constantly using, living to use, using to live, losing jobs, not understanding what was wrong in my life because I never wanted to take accountability for me, feeling sorry for myself, and I bartended. It was a wonderful job. It kept me good for 6 or 8 hours so I could get the money to go do what else I needed to do. So it was my functionability. But, you know, so I was bartending, and there was this guy that used to come in every day, and he would sit down and get a cup of coffee and a sandwich. It was like a sandwich place bar, and he would just eat and drink. And just before he left every day, he would just look at me and say, "Why do you try to kill yourself every day?" And, of course, my mouth, I start with my foul mouth, who wants to hear you? And he would leave. But the sad part was that every night at like 2 or 3 in the morning when I was on my way home, the pain I would feel from his sentence would, I would walk down the street with tears in my eyes thinking, how did I get here? You know, this isn't where I was supposed to be in life. This isn't what I didn't dream. This was where I was going to be at 31 years old. What am I doing here? How did I get to this place? Many, many different situations happened that warranted me walking into my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. But the first meeting that I walked into, I believe, was my first spiritual awakening. Because when I walked in the room, that man was standing there. And he came over and he gave me a hug and he said to me, "Welcome. I've been waiting for you to get here. Let me show you another way to live." And I was overwhelmed when he said that to me. And I was scared and I didn't know how to talk to people. And I felt like I had lost all my social skills. And I was just like, I felt like a deer in the headlights. I was just standing there. I wanted to run, but too many people started to walk over to me. And they said, come on, stay. And that was the first thing that I remember about Narcotics Anonymous. And I felt so welcome. And it was the first place that I remember sitting in a room with 10 or 12 people, and everybody was the same as me. I finally found a place where I fit in. And it was like, this was what I've been waiting for my whole life. I didn't understand how to stay clean. I had no idea what to do. I knew I was sick and tired of my past being my future. And I was tired. I didn't want that to happen to myself anymore. I couldn't do it. I felt like I didn't have enough stamina left to stay out there and do the insanity that I had to do to feed my disease. This person taught me the importance of service work. He got me involved with the women. He got me involved with making coffee, taking commitments. He got me involved with, he taught me the importance of H&I, literature review. All of these things were coming because he was so involved in service and he connected me with those people. Back in that time, the area I come from, meetings were really small. And after a while, you know, you used to get sick of the same 6, 8 people, 10 people talking all the time. I started to realize that the service work was the thing that was getting me to move from that area. Now I was getting involved and I was starting to get in different areas and I was starting to meet more people, and I could see that I was starting to get a little more confidence because my life was starting to come into some semblance of order simply because of the fact that I could go to work, get a paycheck, and stick it in the bank and still have money on Monday, because I used to get paid on Friday at 5 and be broke by 7 and be stealing food by 8. And, you know, now I was thinking, I have some responsibility and I'm getting a life together and this is meaning something to me and I can build relationships. I kept missing out on one of the most important relationships I needed to build was one with myself. I constantly was doing service and I got to be a service junkie. And I was so busy doing service work that I forgot to do the work that was important, myself. Work on Ann, work on these steps, work on change, work on behaviors, thoughts, actions, behaviors. These are the things that got you here. And I got really stuck. And I remember being a couple of years clean and still acting out and having all those sick behaviors and not comfortable in them, but certainly not willing to make a change. And I found out through time that change really wasn't as hard as I made it up to be in myself. I used to put such a huge resistance up to making a change that it made it more difficult. I used men in recovery because I still didn't know how to feel good about Ann. So I needed you to tell me that I look good, or I needed you to tell me I was a good person, because I didn't know how to get that self-esteem or that self-worth within myself. And I realized today that came from the messages that happened to me when I was 5 years old. You know, you're just not good enough. You're never going to make it. Don't try out for that. You're going to be a failure. Instead of doing that, just go sit over there and don't talk. And here I was at 31 years old and 35 years old, still believing the message. And she didn't even have to be with me for that tape to go off in this head. And it stayed with me. So it's probably the voice that I've struggled with the most to quiet in these almost 21 years of this process called recovery. My mother, I understand today, my mother did the best she could with what she had. She came from an abusive home where she was physically abused, and that's what she gave her children because she didn't know what else to do. But I'm going to say today, I didn't deserve it. And I know that today. I didn't deserve to have somebody emotionally incapable of raising me. So when I came in Narcotics Anonymous, one of the first things I learned was that I had to start to repair an Ann. And I had to fix Ann from the inside out, because the little Ann that lived in there was still damaged and still suffering and still insecure. And I got in this process, and I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I tried sales. I tried selling cars. I knew I had to get out of that business when I started, after 2 years, telling the old couples that used to come in how to save money that I was trying to rob them, you know, because they want you to beat the people. And I couldn't do that anymore, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So I decided I was going to go back and finish my education that I had lost through my addiction. And then that voice, it came back again. Because here I was, 36 years old, in a classroom with kids 18. And I didn't feel right. And I was thinking, how do I do this? These people are looking at me like, look at me. And they weren't doing anything. This was all the internal message. Look at her. She's old. She's going to do here. She must be a real loser, 36 years old in school. And that was the message that lived in this brain. And I would do well, and I would do it, and then I'd go home and I'd talk to people, and I'd talk to my husband, and he'd say, there's nothing wrong with you. You're doing really well. You keep telling me how you're going to fail. He said, but every report you bring home is A's. So where's this coming from? And it was still this sickness back here from way back there growing up. It lives with us, and if we don't learn to change that, we don't find peace within. We just don't find that peace. And after a while, it got to be a point where I enjoyed going to class. I'd be the one raising my hand all the time. I liked sitting in the front, and I watched half of them walking around bleary-eyed because they were all loaded from the night before. So, you know, eventually, a couple of them used to ask me, how do you do it? Gave me an opportunity to share what Narcotics Anonymous has done for my life. I got in a relationship at 5 years clean. I stayed out of relationships for a period of time after I kept failing and realized how I was using men. And my sponsor at that time, who constantly put it in my face that I didn't know how to be in relationships and I didn't know how to be with myself and I was using men and yourself, I did what every good addict would do. I fired her. She told me she didn't know I hired her because she didn't know she was on the payroll. I walked away and did what I needed to do. And, of course, I woke up one night at 3 in the morning in this man's apartment, and I thought to myself, what is different? You are still prostituting yourself. You're just doing it without a drug today. Because it's anything I do, I'm worthy of myself, is prostitution to me. So I got up, I left, and I went to a meeting, and I looked for her. With my tail between my legs, very hard to do, a strong dose of humility to walk up to her and say, I don't know how to do this. You were right, and I'm willing to learn now. And that's when I think I was almost at the point of 5 years in this process when I realized I hadn't been working the steps. I was so busy being a service junkie and running to this commitment, that commitment, H&I, literature review, area service, regional service, convention committees, da-da-da-da-da. I didn't stop long enough to work on me. And I haven't put these steps in my life, not really. And that's when I really started to put the pen and the paper and the dictionary and the NA text to work. And that was the beginning of me finding who I am. You know, I thank God for the addiction that he gave to me. I know I was meant to walk the path I walked in this life. I haven't always been thrilled with the path he's had me on. But the path has shown me how to grow and how to live. I think that every challenge that's been in my path has been an opportunity for me to grow, even though some of those challenges have been extremely difficult and very tiring emotionally, mentally, physically. They were there for a reason. I know that people have come into my life, whether they were there for 5 minutes or 5 years or 5 seconds, it doesn't matter how long. I met people and they came in my path for a reason. Every person I've met, I have had something from them that I've taken that has helped me to become the person I want to be today. So I got in this relationship, but I still hadn't worked on the control part. So I got in this relationship. You met him. He spoke a little while ago. And we had this wedding planned because I wanted to have a real wedding this time where I wasn't going to get thrown out because I was clean. So I had this wedding planned. But I forgot to tell him what was a part of the wedding. I forgot he was a part of it. So I planned the wedding, and I planned this, and I planned that, and here we're going here for the honeymoon. Da, 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 da. I said, and I'm telling all you got to do is show up. 2 weeks before the wedding, he sits me down one night, and he says, this isn't working. I don't even know what we're doing. And one of us is going to use, and it's not going to be me. So I'm not getting married. And I said, you're not getting married? The invitations are out. The dresses are all da-da-da. He says, I'm not getting married. I was devastated, and I left, but I ended up on my sponsor's doorstep, and I waited, and I said, I'm still stuck. I don't know how to get rid of this control and this perfectionism. It's killing me in recovery, and I realized I got all those messages back there again from that woman that was raising me, because that's what she did, and I saw now how it wasn't working in my life, and I was tired of losing, so I put some more effort into myself, and put more effort into my step work, and I put some time into some therapy for myself so I could learn about how to fix Anne, all how Anne needed to fix Anne instead of having you fix Anne. You know, we ended up getting married, and by God's grace, in this process called Narcotics Anonymous, we just had 17 years married. You know, and I know how to be in a relationship today. I know how to be a good wife, I know how to be a good listener, I know how to communicate, and I know how to tell you how I feel, even if those times to tell you how I feel are really uncomfortable for me to say, because I'm worried about how you're going to react to what I say. And that still goes back to that fear of rejection. I'm always afraid that maybe you're not going to like me, or maybe I'm not good enough, because that message, it still lives there. I've quieted it over the years, but it still was there. We were able to communicate and have a wonderful relationship, and I'm blessed that I married my best friend. And I knew this guy for about a year and a half, 2 years from meetings, and never would have thought that I would have married him. Last person in the world I even thought of dating. Last person in the world. But I know that he came in my path for a reason. And he's in my life today for a reason. And one of the main reasons is that little girl you see walking around with him. I was afraid to have a child. I was afraid I was going to be my mother. And he always told me, you know, you're different. You've worked on yourself. You continue to work on yourself. You won't be, her name was Yola. And he'd say, you're not going to be Yola. You're Anne. And I was fearful. Through this process of my working on these steps and through recovery living in my life, my mother was able to, before her death, come to terms with how damaging she had been for us growing up. She was able to come to me and sit and ask for help. She was able to go out and seek help for herself, and we were able to have a relationship and make some peace with each other before she left me. I'm really grateful for that. I'm truly grateful for that. I needed to make that closure with her before she left this world. It was important. So just before she left, she had a chronic illness that I used to help take care of her. And before she left, I was 38 years old and said, I want to have a child now. I love my mother so much, and I have this connection. I want to have this with a child. I want to be able to talk and communicate with this child. I want to have something. I want to be someone who can teach and be a good listener and ask somebody, how do you feel, and listen, and be that mother I always wanted. And then I couldn't get pregnant. And 2 years go by, and I can't get pregnant. And so we decided to go artificial insemination, fertility, help with fertility, and I get pregnant on the first time. And the doctor's telling me, you know, you have to go through this probably 7 or 8 times, and if this doesn't work, then you're not going to do this medicine and that, da-da-da-da. And I got pregnant the first time. And I knew when he did it. I don't know how I can tell you that, but I just felt in my heart that when that happened, I knew I was going to have a child. And that was October, and my mother was so thrilled, and I was so excited that she was going to be a part of this process, because she, all she ever wanted was to have a grandchild. And on December 25th, God decided to take her home. So I was really lost. And then Brianna came along 6 months later, and Brianna was really sick. And I didn't know how this happened. And there was a period where that voice came back, and it said, this is what you get for the life you lived as the addicted person, and for all the hurt you've inflamed on many people, this is your wrath. That passed. That only stayed with me for a brief moment, but it was there. And I needed to reach out to my support network and to my sponsor and to my husband so that I could realize that this wasn't a punishment. This was the best gift I ever got. I've learned more from that little girl who can't say anything than I've ever learned in life. I thought when I was 10 years clean before she came to me that I understood unconditional surrender, acceptance. I thought I knew what those words meant. I had no idea what those words meant because Brianna can't speak, so I don't have that dream that I wanted so desperately to be able to sit and talk with my daughter and share her first day at school and know how she felt and listen to what she had to say and, you know, see her go on her first date and get in the car for the first time and probably drive her, go crazy trying to teach her how to drive, and all those dreams that I had for 9 months when I carried her, they weren't there. They were all gone. You know, my analogy is that I had this trip planned. I was going to Italy, and I got through this, and they said, welcome to Holland. And I said, wait a minute, I'm in the wrong place. I'm not supposed to be here. There's nothing beautiful here. I'm going over there. And they said, oh, there's beauty here, but you're going to have to find it. And that's the analogy that I've learned from her. And her determination and her strength teaches me on a daily basis that no matter what challenge I get faced with in this life, I can get through it. I don't have to do anything alone. I've never done anything alone in the 20 years I've been in this process. It's always been we. Whenever the I gets in my way, and it'll crop up, that's me being self-sufficient and forgetting what surrender means. So when I hear the I coming out of my mouth, I know, shut up and listen, because you're not where you're supposed to be. And I tell on myself every time I do that, because I have to stop doing it, and I'm doing it less often. But this little girl again, the man that came in my life, the man that I married him for a reason. The characteristics that I saw in him that made me want to marry him were his strength, his determination, his undying love for his 3 children, the way he would sacrifice doing something he wanted to do because the kids wanted to go do something. And I thought, that's the kind of man I want in my life, and that's the kind of man I would love to have be the father of my child. And I couldn't have asked for a better husband, best friend, companion, father. I couldn't have gotten it any better. So I know God knows what he's doing more than Ann knows. And I relinquished that power. So there are many times that have been difficult in the last almost 10 years of her life. And it's more put me more in the process of needing to be in Narcotics Anonymous and more in the process of needing to utilize my support network, because I've had to reach out many times when I was overwhelmed, when sitting at Children's Hospital, I couldn't do it. I thought I couldn't do it another second, and we lived there for 3 solid years, and how am I going to do this again? And see the eye? But when we'd sit in those waiting rooms after surgery, after surgery, after surgery, we were never alone. There was Narcotics Anonymous with us. There were people from the rooms carrying us when we couldn't carry ourselves. The God of my understanding has given me so many beautiful friendships. And, you know, if you have one decent friendship your whole life, you're really blessed. But look at the friendships we foster in this process called recovery. It's unbelievable. Narcotics Anonymous was always there in times that were difficult. When my mother passed, I was devastated, and you know how, you know, it's difficult. The grieving process alone is difficult, but prior to that, you have to go through the wake and the funeral, and it's overwhelming, and it's very stressful, and people came for 4.5 hours to the point where family were saying, how do they know her? I said, they're not here for her. They're here for me. I don't understand that. I said, you don't have to. They're here to carry me right now. You know, we wanted to take Brianna to this program because she couldn't do anything. She couldn't walk. She couldn't talk. They told her she'll never see, she'll never hear. You heard what he said about the doctor. He didn't spell his name, G-O-D, so we didn't listen to the I nevers. But we had this process we wanted to take her, this program we wanted to take her to, and it was in Florida, and it was really a lot of money, and who had that kind of money? It was like $20,000, and she was in the hospital after her, like, 14th surgery and had this major cranial surgery. She was in there for a month, and one of our friends from Narcotics Anonymous came to the hospital and said, we're having a little party for Brianna, and we want you to come, and it's Jack's anniversary that day, and come, we're going to have a cake. So I said, all right, you know, I had no idea. We had no idea what we were walking into, none. We get to this place, and it's like a building like this, and we walk in. There were 500 recovering addicts in the room, and they all paid $20 to walk in so that Brianna could go and learn something. The power of Narcotics Anonymous, the love that we have inside that we never knew we had, because when we were this little, people didn't give it to us. But look what we learned being in here. The third day down there, Brianna got up and walked. She never walked before. She got up and walked. She went to this program. She said two words, and she started to learn sign language. You know, we cried for a month. We cried. We were in Florida, and every day we cried. And I love those tears. You know, and one of the words that Brianna learned how to say was mom. I can't tell you. And she said that to me, another one of those wonderful spiritual awakenings my God has given me. She said that to me on Mother's Day. Sitting on the living room floor playing, she looked up and went, mom. I was devastated. I'm screaming, Jack! Say it again! Of course she didn't. She never does what I ask her to do when I ask her to do it. Narcotics Anonymous. Who would have thought that an addict who couldn't get a day without a substance to get through, who couldn't stop lying, cheating, stealing, manipulating, who couldn't keep a place to live, could come to this? In the beginning, all I ever wanted was to get a job, be able to pay for a house, and have a car to drive. That's what I wanted. A nice stereo would have been good. I had no idea how much more the God of my understanding was getting ready to give me. So I'm going to tell you the best part of my day every day. It's 3:30 in the afternoon, in my driveway, waiting for that big yellow bus. And when it pulls up and the doors open, I hear mom and these arms and these legs going because she's so excited because she's home. And jumps in my arms and immediately starts signing, I want to play, let's go to the swings, da 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 da. Her little control issues come out. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. We all know that. She's extreme. She's so much like me, it's sometimes frightening. I guess the process that the God of our understanding really wants us to get in Narcotics Anonymous is the relationships we have to build. The one we have to build with ourselves that's most important. The one we have to build with him that is even more important. And then the one we have to build with a sponsor. And I remember thinking, I don't know how to trust people. And you want me to go in these rooms and trust people. Well, I didn't ever have any trouble trusting that the guy on the corner was going to not put strychnine in my bag. I didn't ever have a problem trusting him. I trusted that he was going to take my money and disappear and come back. How crazy was that? But I didn't have any problem trusting him. And people in the rooms are saying to me, you got to trust people and talk about your feelings. I'm like, that's craziness. I understand today that it's so important for me to talk about my feelings. If I talk about the feelings that are happening inside, then I don't act on the feelings. And I'll act on feelings in many different ways. I'll act on feelings by overeating or by going to the mall with a credit card and spending money that I have no business spending and can't pay for the bills when they're going to come in, or by, you know, gambling or whatever, over excess with anything, with exercise, with sex, with anything that will take me outside of myself. That's what it's all about. So the thing I've learned is balance is important, and I did learn to trust. Now, I couldn't identify a feeling if I tripped over it when I walked in the doors of Narcotics Anonymous. I knew two feelings, angry and sad. Happy, you didn't even live there. Because I was so many years angry and sad, I didn't even know happy. And she would say to me, like, well, how do you feel? And I'd say, ugh. And I'd sit there sometimes. So she gave me a sheet. 256 feeling words. She said, study this sheet. You need to learn how to use your mouth and express how you feel. And then I started a journal, and I used to journal at night. How did I feel through the day? You know, these were techniques and things that she taught me to help me learn to identify. So today, I can sit down and tell you how I feel. In a matter of moments, I can process in my head what it is, why it's there. And I realize today feelings are just visitors. They come in and visit, and my day is supposed to be up and down. Not monotone, numb, where I lived for 17 years. That's not normal. I'm not sure I know what normal is, but certainly that's not normal. I think that the important factor that keeps me motivated still today is service, but I learned balance and service. And I still like to be involved in H&I. I love being able to give it back to newcomers as they come in the rooms, in the rehab centers that don't have any hope. I like to go in there to show them that we do recover. We do get better, and we can make it. Literature Review was probably one of my favorite committees, and I would have thought I was going to hate that committee, but it got me involved with a lot of people in a lot of areas, and to be able to go walk in a room and see literature on the table and think, wow, I had a part of sitting down and writing some stuff on that. That's a nice feeling to have. You know, the green and gold book, and we were part of that years ago, sitting down, addicts writing. You know, one of the best things I remember about that is we were trying to talk about how to make the person feel welcome when they walk into the rooms. And there were all these people with all this time, and there was a person with 30 days. And the person with 30 days says, well, you know, you ought to have, like, people that greet you when you walk in. That would make people feel really welcome. Like somebody would stand there and give them a hug. That was the most awesome thing that happened all day, was hearing that guy say that. And now, in a lot of our meetings in our area, we have greeters. People take that commitment on, like, as part of the monthly service work. So look what we can do for each other. When we can't carry ourselves, there's always somebody willing to carry us. All we have to do is be willing to allow people to know where we are and not to go back to that I self-sufficiency, but to recognize I don't have all the answers. And it has nothing to do with the level of intelligence. It has everything to do with just being willing to allow myself out, to be able to trust, and not to be worried if you're going to like me or not like me. You know, there's many people aren't going to that probably don't like me, and that's okay. Maybe they're missing out on finding out the real person. Maybe they made a perception that was wrong behind a look on my face one night. You know, maybe they made a perception about me because of something they heard from somebody else. You know, unfortunately, we're human, and we still don't know how to not judge people. And I think it's an instinct that comes second nature, and it's unfortunate. And I force myself to try to stop that process when I go in places where I don't know people, or even in the homeroom where I do know the people, for not to me get up here and decide what's wrong with you today, when I didn't really sit down to even think about listening to what's wrong with you, why you might have an attitude. Because we know that our attitudes and our old behaviors, they're like gloves. They fit, you know, they're in this closet, these old coats that we just closed the door on. That doesn't mean they went away. And when I'm not in the right place spiritually, they come back out and jump on, and they're comfortable. And boy, that comfort zone. That compulsive comfort zone I go back to, that ease and comfort I used to know. And it has nothing to do with the drink. It has everything to do with the behavior. So I recognize that this is a process that I have to do every day. I do the same things they taught me 20 years ago. Get up, get centered, pray, ask for his grace, make a meeting, talk to another addict, and thank him for the miracle called recovery that you just had in your 24 hours. I'm an addict. My name is Ann, and I appreciate being here. Thank you for listening.